Pad up. It's the Australian Cricket Podcast. And here are your hosts.
Welcome to the Australian Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel, a.k.a. Menners. And joining me this week is my co-host from the Big Smash Cricket Podcast. Welcome, Paul Dennett.
Hey, Menners. Great to be here. Looking forward already to the Australian Tour of India.
Haven't we had fun in press boxes all around various cricket grounds this summer?
It's been amazing, actually. The players have been very friendly. It's been very exciting.
The other guest this week is Joe. How are you, Joe?
I'm very well, Menners. Looking forward to some of those salacious stories coming out of the press boxes around the grounds.
Well, there's a lot to come in this week's edition of the Australian Cricket Podcast. We're going to wrap up the whole test summer. We're going to look ahead to the one-day series versus Pakistan and the interesting squad that the selectors have chosen. We've got a fiery read and react this week. It's one of the first read and reacts where I had a few tweets saying, you've got to talk about this one. So that's gone in. And we'll finish off with our Indian squads for the first test in India in that test series coming up. But let's start with a look at the third test versus Pakistan at the SCG. Australia won the test by 220 runs, but I guess the gap felt a lot larger. Pakistan looked like they were sort of half on the plane home. Is that sort of a fair assessment?
I think that is. I think the momentum from the MCG test flowed through to the SCG, and it was a bit of a steady decline in both the attitude and performance of the Pakistanis. And I think, you know, good to have Paul and I back here to take full credit for our 3-0 predictions in the series. Spot on yet again.
Yes, although as I often say, I also did predict Australia winning 3-0 in Sri Lanka, so I can't take too much credit. But yeah, I think that it was a disappointing performance in the end by Pakistan, and they showed glimpses, Menners, of what they could achieve, but ultimately, if you're going to be continually dropping catches, running between the wickets badly, ground fielding not ideal, taking wickets off no balls, you're not going to be able to beat Australia in Australia.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it even started before the test started. They didn't even train in the lead up to the Sydney test. They basically just fronted up on the morning to play, so I think they were ready to go home.
I think the one major positive is that some of their best performances came from their next generation of players, you know,
Shafiq, Azhar Ali.
Exactly. So, you know, that question about what hole will Yunus and Misbah leave, I think is probably, you know, they're in some pretty good hands there.
David Warner lit up the test match twice, hitting a century before lunch on the first day of the test match. It was an absolutely breathtaking start to the test match. And there's now just five players in the whole history of test cricket that have scored a century before lunch. Those five players are now Trumper, McCartney, Bradman, Majid Khan and David Warner. And the last time it was done was over 40 years ago in 1976. It was one of the most amazing beginnings to a Sydney test I've ever seen. What do you guys think?
Oh, it was immense. And as a person growing up who spent far too much time reading cricket books from the dim, distant past, it's amazing that you can add Warner to the list of those three Australian names. That Trumper in 1902, McCartney in 1921, and Bradman in 1930 are something that all fellow cricket nerds like me would know. To suddenly be able to say Warner 2017 as well, it's an absolute delight.
And it's quite amazing in the T20 era that it hasn't been done since 1976. And I think the amazing thing about the innings is it wasn't, you know, he wasn't taking absolutely outlandish strokes. It was a very, you know, he played great cricket strokes. And that's one of the things that's amazing about David Warner in 2016-17 is that he plays these innings at more than a run a ball, but he's playing traditional cricket strokes and he's taking measured risks.
Yeah, the way he played, as you say, not playing any outlandish strokes. He just looked like you couldn't imagine anyone batting any better than he did. And let's hope that the next couple of years he really does capitalise on that. And he's got the potential to be something averaging close to 60 in Test cricket. Let's hope we see it.
So he brought up that century in just 72 balls. It's the fastest Test ton at the SCG, breaking his own record from a year ago. It's his third in a row at the ground. And I thought it was something of a surreal beginning. I mean, it's amazing when a test match gets off to that sort of really fast start like that. And then there was a sort of a lull in the afternoon for a while. But then young Matty Renshaw took over and he made a superb 184, really almost a coming of age moment for him. And a couple of things stood out for me about his innings, apart from, you know, the skill and the shot making, was the way he was able to keep his cool while Warner was going off to such a quick start. And then Renshaw batted very patiently through the second second session, didn't feel like he had to sort of try and do a David Warner. But then in the last session, when the Pakistan bowlers were at his mercy, he really capitalised and scored about 100 runs in that session. I thought it was just a really mature innings and something really promising for the future.
I think that's right, because it would be difficult batting with somebody like David Warner who scores so quickly. You know, he's on 100 and you're on 15 runs. It would bring pressure on some people. But as you say, he's got such a cool head. And what he realises is that, you know, if he occupies the crease for long enough, he will get his time to shine. And that's exactly how that first day played off. He was played out. He was very patient and then really plundered the attack in the evening session, didn't he?
Yeah, and congratulations to the selectors as well. They cop a lot of criticism. For them to have gone out and picked this young player at this time and for it to have turned out so well, they deserve tremendous accolades for that.
And then before we leave the Warner and Renshaw show behind, it would be remiss not to mention David Warner's half-century in the second innings. He brought his 50 up off just 23 balls. It's the fastest Test 50 by an Australian batsman. And the record is held by Misbah Al-Haq, who has the fastest Test half century of 21 balls. So both record holders on the ground. I think David Warner came out with the intention of going for McCullum's record from the beginning. I think Smith gave him a license because they were looking to declare, and he just put on another hitting display.
He did, and I was there, and it was just a magic period. But again, until the shot that he got out on, he didn't actually play too many crazy shots. He was just much more aggressive, but still playing fairly orthodox cricket shots. And it rendered the innings by Smith, which was one of the fastest 50s of all time, look pedestrian by comparison. And Khawaja, who was scoring at a fairly decent rate, looked looked ridiculously slow. It was a remarkable little innings.
So David Warner lit up the Test match twice. But let's now move on to something where something was faintly lit up on the Snicko, and I think was a controversial moment. We saw Steve Smith given out with the smallest, faintest touch on Snicko, and then Wahab Riaz in the second innings for Pakistan was given out when Snicko just had the smallest spike. Both of you, do you think that is the way DRS should be used? That if you have a tiny little faint spike on Snicko, that's enough evidence to give someone out?
I think it is enough, providing that it's absolutely simultaneous with the ball passing the edge of the bat. Particularly in Riaz's dismissal, I have an issue with that. To me, it looked as though the sound occurred half a frame after the ball had passed the bat. And it sounded almost a strange sort of foreign alien sound that was occurring at the time, rather than the ball hitting the edge of the bat. That, for me, would have been enough for it to be given not out. The only thing I'll say in the third umpire's defence is that they have been given a lot of training with producers to be able to work that out. And so I hope that the third umpire was able to say, no, that was simultaneous enough for it to be given, and me as the casual viewer got it wrong. But in terms of the smallness of the spike, I think ultimately if the spike's there, then you've got to say that that's probably good enough.
To me, there's been a change in philosophy about what the third umpire is being used for. I mean, I know that we talk about it being introduced to take the howler out of the game, and now I think it's being used quite differently to almost in a, you know, going into the sort of minutiae of the situation to overturn an umpire's decision. So, you know, I don't think that that was what you would call conclusive evidence. And I think if you're going to overturn something, it needs to be conclusive evidence. I think in both cases, there was nothing on the stump mic. There was nothing on the hot spot. And it was a very small spike on the Snicko. So I disagreed with both decisions.
Yeah, I agree with you, Joe. I think they were both unfortunate decisions. And I think DRS is more there for the clear error than that fine, hard-to-track dismissal.
The other point with the Riaz one was that the front-on hotspot was not available. It further emphasises that the ICC need to take responsibility for DRS rather than relying on the broadcaster who is just doing, you know, they're doing TV. They need to have it themselves so they can control it and so that there are never any camera angles missing.
Now, a couple of incidents during the Test match that might have had traditionalists up in arms. Let's start with the Usman Khawaja dab dance celebration when he scored his half century in the second innings. Provoked a lot of reaction on social media, whether it was appropriate for a Test player to do a dab dance when he scored a Test half century. The ground loved it. The kids loved it. I guess with Big Bash fever in the air, it's all about dancing. So what do you guys think?
I loved it. I mean, it told me what dabbing was. I was there with my cousin's son, and I had no idea, and I felt every bit of my 39 advanced years that this 17-year-old was able to bring me up to the modern world. Fantastic. Fun. Who cares? It's great.
Absolutely. Harmless bit of fun. You know, I think we see some pretty out there celebrations of people, you know, running 50 metres from the pitch. So this was pretty mild in comparison, I think.
Good on him. Now, another incident that involves Spider Cam. Now, I've gone on record many times on this show by saying I think Spider Cam is one of the worst things in modern cricket, and I think it needs to be banished. And we saw in this game one of the problems with Spider Cam, that whoever's controlling it obviously has no idea about what's going on, because we saw Hilton Cartwright get a nasty blow to the groin when he was fielding in close. And, you know, after the incident, he needed to adjust himself and make sure everything was in the right spot. And Spider Cam just hovered above his head, trying to take a peek into what Hilton was doing. Very inappropriate from Spidey. And then we saw Spider Cam obviously banished after that. Someone in the Australian cricket team complained about Spidey's, you know, being a bit of a pervert, and they banished him to deep square leg for the rest of the test match, which I enjoyed. What do you guys think?
I think it's funny that Spider Cam's almost taken on the personality of a human in your eyes, Menas. I love Spider Cam. I think that it brings great angles, and I'm not saying that just to disagree with you.
I think you are.
I don't know that there's anything too egregious about it. Occasionally, yeah, the ball might hit the wires and that's a problem. But otherwise, I think it brings excellent camera angles and...
But when you watch a game that doesn't have Spider Cam, most coverage from around the world doesn't, do you ever go, I wish this game had Spider Cam?
But it's innovation, Menas. I agree with Paul to an extent. You get angles that you simply weren't available previously. I think...
Well, Hilton Cartwright, there's almost a few angles on him that no one needed to see.
Exactly.
Amazing test debut.
When you're live at the ground, you get a sense of how close it actually is to the action. And I can understand that it could be distracting at times, particularly when you're batting. If it was in your field of vision at all, it would be incredibly distracting.
I think whoever operates Spider Cam, if they're going to continue with this experiment, that they need someone that really knows the game.
It sounds like you're putting your hand up for that job, man.
That'd be ironic. I think there was a German firm that first started it, and I remember a piece a few years ago about how this German guy was brought out who had invented Spider Cam, and he had to be taught the laws of cricket so that he could operate it. I think it was a wonderful story. This really smart German guy was learning cricket. I thought it was really cool.
And now, speaking of random people in cricket, before we move on, I would like a listener to write in and just tell us who the new Stern is in the Duckworth, Lewis and Stern calculation. All
it's
of
like a
sudden,
law firm. There's been a new partner introduced.
Or someone sued and said, look, I was there. You know, it's like one of the Beatles from the, you know, I was there when you came up with this. Put me on it. So if anyone knows the story behind that, would love to hear it.
I think I kind of do. I think...
I said listeners, but go on. Go on.
I think Duckworth and Lewis are of advanced vintage now and have kind of decided that they've bequeathed their legacy to the world and that they've let Stern take over. And Stern is the person charged with bringing Duckworth Lewis into the modern era.
So what is the innovation that Stern has brought to that algorithm?
Well, I think that his job is to recognise that 20 years ago, a side chasing 200 in a one-dayer who were... 2 for 100 when the rain came, you might have said, oh, they're going to struggle. Now you'd say, oh, they're going to absolutely walk it in. So I think he's going to bring it up to date with modern trends. And Kevin Peterson has a very serious issue that he needs to bring it up, that he thinks Stern needs to bring it up to date much more for T20 cricket. It seems outdated. And I think he's probably right. So Stern needs to get some work done.
So all Stern has done is adjust it to a new runs per over. What a genius.
I don't want to disparage Stern too much.
If anyone can give us the full story, OzCricketPod, AUSCricketPod @gmail.com. So that's four consecutive whitewashes for Australia over Pakistan on our home soil. So Pakistan need to do a bit of work if they're going to challenge us down under. I think a couple of figures stand out for why Pakistan was so abysmally bad in this series. Yasir Shah, 148.1 overs, conceding runs at over 4.5 and over, and he just took 8 wickets in the series at 84. Horrifically bad figures, and it's hard to even predict that they would have been so bad going into the series. And Misbah-ul-Haq, 76 runs at 12.66. To see their captain and leader fall so far below par, combine that with Shah, two key bad performances for Pakistan.
Yeah, and in terms of the whitewash, Ian Chappell said something saying that maybe Pakistan shouldn't bother to turn up if they're not going to play better, which a lot of people then said, well, look at Australia's recent record in Asia. It's pretty deplorable as well. But this is now 30 test series throughout history that Asian teams have visited Australia, and they have never won a series. Whereas in Australia has visited Asia 30 times and have won 12 series and lost 15. So I think Australia haven't done so well of recent times, but it doesn't hide from the fact that subcontinental sides, when they're coming down here, have really underperformed and they need to get better.
Stat alert. Great stat there from Paul. Just go back 15 seconds and replay it. Listen to it again. Well done, Paul. Love it. Deserves a replay. Now, let's sort of look at the test summer as a whole for Australia. Australia won 4 tests. They lost 2. There were no draws, which is great for the fans. Results cricket. Rod Marsh was dumped as chairman of selectors and Trevor Holmes has come in. Into the selection panel came Greg Chappell. What do you guys think about the test summer as a whole? Would you say it's a pass for Australia or a failure, considering we lost the series to South Africa? How do you reflect now that there's been some distance since the Hobart debacle?
You'd have to say you really want to see what happens in the next couple of years. If Australia's new generation go to India and perform well and then become the number one test side in the world, you'd look to this and say this was where it began and you can forgive the poor performance against South Africa. But you do need to have that distance to be able to assess, because on the face of it, beating Pakistan, you would be expected to do that. Losing to South Africa is indeed disappointing. So on just the pure results, you'd have to say it was a poor summer.
Yeah, I think this is actually quite reflective of the post-2005 era, in that we don't seem to be able to get a read of, long-term form line for this test team. We seem to have a good series and then it's a bit of one step forward, two steps back at times. And I think that's kind of, reflective of the summer, albeit, I think that what we have now done is chosen a side with some youngsters who are going to play a big part for a long... We've given credit to the selectors for Hanscom and Renshaw. So I think, that's the most positive thing about the summer, is that we've now, I think, got the nucleus of the side that will be, I think, relatively successful over the next few years. But I still, this is not the Ponting, Steve Waugh-led sides. There's no doubt about that. We're still going to struggle in some conditions.
It's hard to give Australia a pass mark when they lose a series at home. So I would say it hasn't been a pass mark for Australia, but as you said, there've been some positives. I just think you look back to the beginning of the summer, and it was fair to say that Pakistan were expected to be a tougher challenge, and South Africa, with a lot of their main players out, were expected to be a little bit easier, and it sort of reversed. And I just think for us to be so embarrassingly bad at home in this Hobart test, it'll be hard to forget that. So I think, no, it's not a pass, but as you say, sort of the next couple of years will determine whether this change has been a positive one.
I had a friend at uni who specialised in getting 43% and then arguing his way into a pass conceded. Maybe it's about that level.
Now, a couple of victims. We saw Joe Burns come into the summer, struggled in Sri Lanka but did so well at home last summer. He's been dispatched. And Peter Neville, he's also been dispatched. So they seem to be the main victims of the reworking of the test side. But the big five, I'm calling them in Australian cricket, really stood out. So let's start with Usman Khawaja, 581 runs at an average tick under 60. He scored 1 century and 2 90s, really consolidated his position at number 3.
Yeah, and good on him too. He had the disappointment, and I think he was bitterly disappointed at being dropped in the Sri Lankan series. He's come back strongly. It's all to play for now in India for him.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more, I think, when we talk about our teams for India. But I think, Khawaja was the victim of some very short-term reactions to his form over his career. And I think now we just have to stick by him and say, number 3 is to me, that's the nucleus of the batting lineup, and he's performed well enough to hold on to that spot for a long time. Now, I think he's shown that he can play fast-paced innings, or he can occupy the crease depending on what the situation game is.
I think this summer displayed his fighting qualities more than any other summer had, especially against South Africa in Adelaide under really tough conditions. He batted patiently against a good attack. And look, he's always going to get out sometimes in a casual manner, or it appears casual, a bit like Mark Waugh, sort of a windy whoosh, but that's the way he plays. But he countered that with some grit and determination, and you need that from your number 3. Let's move on to Super Smith, Captain Fantastic, the greatest batsman of our time. 50 tests, an overall average now, a tick over 60 in test cricket. This summer, 653 runs at 72. It's just amazing. I mean, you got any more adjectives?
Superlatives?
Yeah, superlatives to add?
Not really, other than it just continues to amaze me that, you know, a guy who didn't start his career as a specialist batsman is now, as I said in our last podcast, statistically our second best batsman behind Don Bradman. And there's nothing to suggest that he won't maintain this level, albeit we know that Ricky Ponting was averaging 60 after 100 tests and couldn't maintain that towards the end of his career. So it'll be interesting to see, can he maintain this super high level?
Absolutely. And can he do it in Asia? There's still a lot of people out there who have a question mark against him. I don't. But a lot of my friends on Twitter from the subcontinent say, well, let's see him really dominate a few series in the subcontinent before we can give him the absolute accolades. I really hope he does that. I think he can. I think he will. And I think that maybe with the exception or the equal of Ponting in around that 2003-04 era, I don't think I can remember in my lifetime an Australian batsman as batting as well as he is now.
People talk about the Hobart test as being the making of him as a leader. He really stood up and came out with some very strongly worded comments about the performance. But I just love Steve Smith. And what I love about him is the way he displays his emotions. He's not like a Ponting or a Steve Waugh where they're quite icy.
Steely.
He really does get into the game. And I love that sort of youthful way he leads the side. So just a great leader of this country. And obviously he needs to grow and develop, but just huge admiration for him. Now let's move on to the last batsman in the Big Five, David Warner. 592 runs, 6 tests at an average of almost 54. He struggled a bit early against South Africa, but then filled his boots against Pakistan. And he continues to just creep up that list of test centuries. He's now got 18. Just a bit like Matty Hayden, when he gets going, he's hard to stop, isn't he?
Absolutely. He, you know, we've talked about how he makes runs now so easily playing good cricket shots. I think that it'll be interesting to see whether he can maintain that level of aggression in India. I know that the Indians criticised the English in the recent series for not adjusting their level of aggression to those conditions. But we know that Matty Hayden, to use your comparison, was so successful in India by playing his natural flowing game, hitting sixes, lofting the ball. So should he just continue in that vein, Menas? I think he's the sort of guy that if he tries to curb his natural style, it won't happen for him.
Yeah, I think he needs to play his natural game over there. And he has a lot of experience in India. And, you know, playing in the IPL 2 months every year gives you not just the familiarity with the wickets and everything, but also you just feel more comfortable there. You've experienced the sights, the smells.
Playing with a dodgy curry in your stomach.
No, I think I agree with you guys that he needs to play his natural game in India. And he's got that beautiful gear where he's scoring quickly without having to play outlandish shots. If he goes into his shell, he'll fail in India. And I'm really, again, with Smith. It's a huge series, this one coming up for Australia. I think it's the biggest test series that we've faced for a long time. Maybe take out the Ashes, but it's massive, and I think that Warner should be able to dominate it.
And then the two bowlers in the Big Five, Mitchell Starc, 28 wickets at 32. I think what's interesting about Mitchell Stark's summary is that he was really curtailed by that unfortunate injury where he ran into a spike at training. And we said at the time that it was embarrassing for a major international cricketer to injure himself at training in a mishap, that someone's put a spike in the wrong place. And you could tell he didn't hit the ground running this summer because he wasn't playing. And so I think that's why his figures are a bit inflated.
Yeah, I thought he bowled without luck at times in this series. I think he beat the bat a hell of a lot. You know, sometimes when you're bowling at 150 clicks and you're moving the ball off the seam, you're bowling too well almost. So I think he is, you know, his stats weren't as good as Hazelwood, but I think he bowled, you know, quite well.
Yeah, I'm a huge Mitchell Starc fan, and it's a qualified success this summer. He averaged 30 against South Africa, and then that dipped to 34 against Pakistan.
But you've also got to look at when he took his wickets, right? There were a couple of times when the test matches were absolutely on the line and he took critical wickets. You know, I'm thinking in particular in that the middle test of the series.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he had a good summer, but
that's what you expect from your striker.
He didn't start in with the great rhythm, and yeah, I just think that whole injury thing at the beginning of the summer cost him.
He was short of a gallop in the first test,
and then Hazelnut really almost a coming of age summer. He dominated the attack. He took 32 wickets at 21. McGrath-like figures that we've all been yearning for. And out of the 120 wickets in the Test summer, 60 were taken by a combination of Stark and Hazelwood. So they took half the Test wickets for Australia this summer. Any other players you want to mention before we move on from this Test summer, gentlemen?
Well, I think the only other one, and we're going to talk about it again in our India preview, is Nathan Lyon. And, you know, I think you've got to recognise that, like Stark, he took some wickets at some crucial times when Tests were on the line, which was the big question mark over him. So he's the only player who I'd say, in my mind, his stocks rose over this summer.
I mean, it's a great call, because going into the Adelaide day-night Test, if Stephen O'Keefe had been fit, you know, he would have played instead of Lyon, but Lyon got some crucial wickets on the fourth afternoon to help bowl Australia to victory, and obviously became a cult hero because of Wade's stupid, incessant chatter behind the stump.
Well, look, I'd love to love Lyon like you guys seemingly are doing.
No, I don't love Lyon. I'm just being a realistic analyst.
I think he had a pretty poor summer. I mean, he averaged 57 with the ball against South Africa with a strike rate of 97, and then against Pakistan, he averaged 45 with a strike rate of 75. I take your point that, yeah, he took some wickets at some crucial times, but ultimately, six test matches are a rather large sample size. Those are figures that, you know, Steve Waugh as a bowler would be ashamed to produce. I want him to do well in India. I can't bring myself to think that he will.
Well, a scathing assessment of Nathan Lyon by Paul Dennett. And that is the end of the Test summer in Australia. Six tests done and dusted now. We look forward to the one-day series versus Pakistan, then the tour of India and beyond. Lots of big bash cricket going on. I always love starting the year with the Sydney Test. I think it is the greatest way to start any year. Spend a few days at the Sydney Cricket Ground. I go to every day of the Sydney Test pretty much. But then there's a bit of a lull afterwards when the Test summer is over. There's been calls that could they extend the Test summer. Do you guys feel a bit sad now that that's it?
I think what happens these days is that because the tests are quite condensed, you sort of look forward all year to the Test match summer, and then it's over so quickly, and you think, I can't believe that it's gone, and there's no longer that anticipation for the one days that there used to be. That there used to be, oh well, the Test summer's over, but now the one day series starts, that's going to be really exciting. That's dissipated a little bit, so you do feel a bit empty early in January, I think.
Spoken like a couple of cricket tragics. I think those days when you've got the Test and the BBL on, isn't that just absolute cricket tragic?
It is
heaven.
Absolute heaven. Well, that's the Test summer. Let's talk about now the squad that was announced for this series versus Pakistan. I think we've seen a shift here in the way the Australian selectors compose this one-day side. Some notable omissions and a few younger players coming in. Let's look at the people that have been excluded from this one-day squad. Firstly, Aaron Finch has been dropped. 450s in his last 18 innings was said not to be enough by the selectors. Do you think they've just said, nope, you got to go away and get some form under the belt, or is it a change in direction for him?
I don't think it's necessarily a permanent change in direction, but I do think his stats in T20 cricket versus one-day cricket are extraordinary, that in T20 cricket he goes along at a vastly higher clip than in one-day games, and I think that if he was able to be hypnotised into thinking that he was playing in a T20 game in a one-day, it would be all the better for him.
I think he looked like a player who was playing with the pressure of his spot, and you know he was I think not scoring at his natural run rate because he was feeling a little bit, you know, like his place was under pressure. Who will take that opening spot, Menas, in this team? Do you think, will it be Khawaja?
Maxwell.
Yeah, I'm hoping it is Glenn Maxwell. I hope they do that. The other one excluded from the team was George Bailey. He just scored one half century in his last 10 innings. I think it's going to be harder for him to get back in the side given his age.
I think they have probably made the right call there, and I'm a big fan of Bailey, but ultimately you've got to ask the question, is he going to be turning out for Australia in the first game of the World Cup in 2019? His age at that stage will really count against him, so I think, regrettably, they might have gone in the right direction there.
And then Hilton Cartwright was excluded after coming into the squad for the last one-day series. I think they wanted to bring him into the Test and one-day squad and get him some experience, and now he can go away and work on his game.
That's one of those unusual mixed messages to send to a young player, to bring them in and then exclude them again without them having played a game.
I think there's this feeling amongst the Australian setup that you want to bring someone in and just make them feel comfortable around the guys, do a few training sessions, maybe have a talk to them about where you see their role in the Australian team in the future.
Just like Brett Jeeves.
Oh, we'll get to that one. And let's look at the inclusions in the Australian one-day squad, because there's some really exciting ones. Chris Lynn comes in on the back of stunning BBL form. Can he translate the Big Bash form into Australian one-day form?
Very prescient question, Manners, because clearly part of this selection process has been that the Big Bash
very
form...
Very good English as well.
Big Bash form has been used. And, you know, I think from if you listened closely to Mark Waugh's commentary, you could have picked some of these selections. What do we think about Big Bash form being used as the primary, I guess, nursery of ODI talent? Is that just
natural?
Well,
I don't think it is. The only reason they picked Chris Lynn, because he has a really good first-class record. He has quite a good one-day domestic record. So I think this has sort of just carried him over the line. You've got to be in form at the right time.
Yeah, I think that you've got to use the BBL form because it's the main form that's available. And the way that Chris Lynn was playing, there would have been an outcry if he hadn't been picked in the Australian side. And I think the outcry would have been justified. I really hope he does go in and succeed. I think the only reason he might not is that he's got this dodgy shoulder that keeps on bothering him. If he can get that right and play with the freedom that he plays in the Big Bash, I think he'll be a very big success at one-day level.
Well, I agree with Lynn, and I think Lynn could play tests. He's that talented. I was thinking more along the lines of Stanlake, who's only played 4 List A games. And this, again, is a bit of a change in selection philosophy where, you know, we used to like to look at players over, you know, 3, 4, 5 years before getting Australian selection, whereas now you can just have a little spike in form and that's enough to win you an Australian shirt.
I think it also highlights the devaluing of one-day cricket. Everyone knows that these 5 games will be forgotten so quickly that you might as well give him a go because this is the best way to find out. You've kind of got nothing to lose. It did kind of cost them when they picked an experimental lineup in the Australian side that went to South Africa just recently, but might as well see what he's got to offer.
Yeah, Billy Stanlake is 204 centimetres tall. He's only played 2 first-class games. I think his inclusion is also due to the injuries around the fast bowling group. James Pattinson's not available yet for the one-day squad. You've also got Berendorf, Paris and Coulton Isle all injured. They're probably 4 players that would have been slightly ahead of Stanlake before this summer. But I think great to see. I mean, he does look like he's got something.
He'll
certainly shake up the Pakistani batsmen.
He's the second tallest
Biscuits Khan jumping around.
Second tallest international cricketer to play behind a Pakistani.
Is it Wahab Rehaz or is it?
No, it's Muhammad Irfan.
Wow.
See, that's all. Wow. He was too, yeah.
2 other players in the squad that I want to highlight. Usman Khawaja wasn't picked in the last one-day squad, but he's been put back in there after his superb test summer. And he's a funny one. They seem to gravitate between having him in the limited overside and chucking him out. Do you guys think he's a 50-over player?
I think so. I mean, his performance in last year's Big Bash was exemplary. I have no problems with him being in there. I would have picked him, yeah.
Joe's just nodding, so I'll take that as a yes. The other one that surprised me a little was Glenn Maxwell was included in the squad, and I thought perhaps after his exclusion from all the games against New Zealand, where he was an excellent drinks runner but didn't play, I thought maybe the selectors were just going to consign him to Big Bash for the rest of the summer, but he might go in there and open the batting.
Well, the funny thing is, you're talking about should we be using Big Bash form to select the one-day side. This is a case where they're going to use one-day form to select the test side, because I think if Maxwell has a bumper 5-game series against Pakistan, he will go in the Australian test side to India. Boof on commentary the other night kind of indicated that was a possibility. So I think that just shows the modern age that's the way they do things. And obviously he's got to be in the Australian side. He's so good.
A couple of other things about this one-day squad. Matthew Wade still the keeper. The fast bowling unit for Australia is quite impressive. Cummins, Stark, Stanlake and Hazelwood. A really good quartet that you think should dominate Pakistan. And the other one I thought deserved consideration was Peter Hanscom. Had such an amazing test summer. He's done well in limited overs cricket in the past. Do you think he should have been given a go in the squad? I mean, remember when Steve Smith burst onto the test scene but wasn't picked for the one-day squad, and then as soon as he came in, he lit up the one-day game? Are we missing a trick here, not having Hanscom in?
I think if I was picking a side for my life, I'd pick Hanscom as the keeper over Wade on batting form. That Hanscom smashed... Hanscom smashed a 50 at the SCG in double quick time.
That was like a full toss outside off stump for Paul there.
Well, as I've always said, you pick your best 11 and then you choose a keeper.
Well, I'm going to let that go through to the keeper and move on now. Well, so the one-day series is coming up against Pakistan. Tune in when the Big Bash is not on, the one-day games against Pakistan are on. So cricket, cricket, cricket. Let's move on now to the Have a Go, Your Mug promotion. Now, remember, go on to iTunes or whatever app you listen to the show on and leave a review for the show. Then email me with the review because I only really see Australian iTunes. And then when you've done that, you will go in the draw for a Have a Go, Your Mug mug. If that's not too complicated, go to the Patreon website and sign up for $5 a month or more and you can get a mug straight away. And thank you to all the people who do subscribe on Patreon. If you want to go on and join that, that's much appreciated. Now, we've got four people in the draw this week for the Have a Go, Your Mug mug. We've got a Stitcher review from Gareth Leeds. Then we've got three from iTunes. We've got Cola Mac, Laurie, and Aussie James. Now, I'm going to come over here. Joe, can you draw a winner out and read the review?
Absolutely, Manners. And the winner is, Manners, Laurie B78. So congratulations to Laurie. And what he's had to say about the Australian Cricket Podcast was, stumbled across Manners & Co. when looking for something cricket-related to entertain me on my daily commute to and from work on the train. The boys consistently provide great insight and general hilarity and shenanigans, as well as some cricket-related banter to boot. Very glad I found you. Keep up the good work. P.S. I broke my favourite mug last night, so looking for more.
Well, well done, Laurie. You have a replacement for your broken mug. Thanks for the lovely review. As ever, if you want to get in touch with the Australian Cricket Podcast, we're on Gmail, auscricketpod, auscricketpod @gmail.com. You can tweet it. Tweet us at Oz Cricket Pod, AUS Cricket Pod. We're on Facebook as the Australian Cricket Podcast. Tell all your cricket-loving friends about the Australian Cricket Podcast, and we'll be back in a moment with Read and React. Kevin, are you going to give Mark Waugh some stick when you get back in the box?
Nah, I saw him this afternoon. It wasn't stick, it was just chit-chat, mess about, banter.
Is it friendly banter?
Yeah, absolutely, 100% friendly banter, yes, yes. I mean, I was with him here today, and we chatted a good 10, 15 minutes. It's nothing. Unfortunately, in the modern world, the modern way of picking up on things is on social media. And I know all too well about social media and the comeuppances of it. And when people start voicing opinions and it starts to get a bit of traction, then people start to make a bit of noise about it. And let them make their noise. There's no issue. I love Junior. I respect him. He was one of the greatest players and one of the players that I loved watching. Whenever he batted, I watched Junior, because he was just, he's just a superstar. And I share the commentary box with superstars, and I love it, and I respect them. And if he can give me, I give him. Same as with Punner and all his golf chat. So it's all good fun, real good fun. It's a great box.
Welcome back to the Australian Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mansell. I'm here with Paul and Joe. And let's move on to Read and React. And actually, Read and React wasn't going to make it into this show, but how could I leave out Brett Jeeves and Darren Lehman having an all-in media fight on Twitter and on Jeeves writing articles for Fox Sports? It's been great to watch. What do you guys think?
Yeah, well, I think Brett Jeeves has positioned himself as the dissenting voice in Australian cricket. We know that he made comments about the poisonous atmosphere in the Australian cricket dressing room under the Clark regime. And now he's made some comments which were critical of Darren Lehman, and particularly his comments about Renshaw. And didn't Lehman hit back hard?
Yeah, so Brett Jeeves questioned Lehman's comments about Renshaw, and then in response to that, Lehman was asked about those comments. He said, Lehman said, I don't listen to Brett. He wasn't a very good player.
Which prompted a lot of people on Twitter to write things such as, I don't listen to such and such a crime writer. He wasn't a very good criminal.
Yeah, not the most well thought out comments from Darren Lehman. I would have thought was he, with his vast media training, he just give some very vanilla answer like, everyone's allowed their opinion and, you know, good on him. And everyone, so this goes away. But he sort of inflamed the situation, didn't he?
But actually what Jeeves said in the original comments was not particularly inflammatory. I thought the same thing. I thought, you know, you've got an incumbent young test opener who's just performed really well, and you don't go into bat for him when asked a question about a future selection. So I actually don't think that Jeeves was coming off the long run-up in his comments.
I think he's just outside the establishment now, and that everything he says inflames them. I think Lehman regrets having a go at him, because when Jeeves' article was tweeted out, this one here, Lehman actually then quoted and said, "Well written, at Brett Jeeves, enjoyed reading this one," which is kind of, do you take that to mean that it was sarcastic? Do you, it's hard to know what to take it to mean as, but I think it's Buff trying to reassert that he's, yeah, I'm a common friendly guy, I can take a bit of criticism.
So after Lehman said he didn't listen to Brett, this is what Brett wrote in his column. And he built up to this, and I go and find this article by Brett Jeeves because there's some really insightful stuff about the psyche of Australian cricket, but this is what he sort of goes on to. "It's ingrained in him as a defence mechanism to either call me as a shit bloke or a shit cricketer, yet all he has unwittingly achieved is to provide us with an example of the types of attitudes that still exist in our game, a recognition that the foundation for the code is real and that the views of anyone that didn't play at a higher level than Buff should be mocked, ridiculed and sent to the wasteland of internet-based journalism, regardless of the depth of knowledge, experiences and fact provided to support the view."
A footnote
in that article also points out that in the four games Jeeves bowled to Lehman, he dismissed him three times.
And he signed off saying bunnies is anybody, claiming that Darren Lehman had been his bunny, which was a fairly strong response from Brett Jeeves. And I think the other thing he did in the article was talk about this very formalised hierarchy within Australian cricket that goes all the way from grade cricket up to the national team. And do we see that as influencing those that get a voice on team selection? I know that, you know, Junior sits there and will take comments from his ex-teammates like Ponting and Fleming about selections. Would he take that as well if it was somebody who hadn't played Australian?
Like Brett Jeeves.
Yeah, like Brett Jeeves.
Well, I think it's a really good point. And the ironic thing, in my opinion, is that many times during his test career, Darren Lehman was overlooked for the Australian side, probably because the selectors at the time were just ex-cricketers who possibly lacked some of the analytical ability that someone outside of cricket could have brought. I think if you'd had a bit of a statistics nerd in charge of the Australian selection committee during Lehman's era, he would have played a lot more test cricket because he was such a good player and should have played more. And I think that's quite an ironic little footnote to this.
Yeah, and I think as well as selection pathways, there's coaching pathways that come into question as well, that, you know, if you've played for Australia, you seem to sort of jump the queue in coaching jobs. And I think there's a certain frustration among players that didn't play for Australia but want to become professional coaches.
Well, we've got a very current example of that where Justin Langer got to choose Ricky Ponting as one of his co-coaches for the T20 team. So that's clear jobs for the boys. That's not arm's length kind of selection process.
But yeah, I agree. Ponting did coach in the IPL last summer.
I'm not saying he wasn't qualified. He's heavily qualified, but Langer got to make the call and chose an ex-teammate, his ex-captain. I agree with Paul, though. It's interesting to hear those comments about Darren Lehman, because he actually was probably one of those players who was on the periphery of the real core of the Australian team, and a bit like somebody like Brad Hodge, probably played a lot less tests than he would have in another era, and I think probably because he wasn't part of that really inner sanctum. So, you know, maybe the criticism doesn't really apply as Jeeves has sort of suggested.
I don't know if you guys saw Darren Lehman on the Big Bash coverage recently, and he was commentating. And they didn't ask him about his public fracas with Brett Jeeves. So I don't think Lehman wants to enter into this battle because he seems to have lost. I think Brett Jeeves really nailed it with this article. I thought it was well written, had some really insightful points. And it just sort of made Darren Lehman look a bit, I don't know, not in touch or something.
Well, I agree. And I think that it shows that Australian cricket does have a gap where this whole, well, how many wickets did you take philosophy needs to change. And they need to say, just because you were a brilliant player doesn't mean you're going to be a brilliant coach. Doesn't mean you won't be, but quite often it does, because the brilliant players, everything comes naturally for them. Darren Lehman famously recently did a PowerPoint presentation on coaching, and on the batting slide he had his headline was WTBI, watch the ball, idiot, except he didn't use the word idiot. He used a much less family-friendly word. And that was the kind of extent of it. It's like, well, you just watched the ball. That's what I did. I was so naturally gifted, I watched the ball and hit it. Why can't you do the same? We need more players. We need more voices who have come at it from a much more analytical, methodical background who can do more than that, I think.
Well said, Paul, and well edited. good discretionary use of language there.
I want to know what the unfamily friendly word starting with I is.
No, it wasn't starting with I.
It starts with C. You can fill in the rest. Now, let's move on now to, let's leave read and react there and move on now to the squad for India. Darren Lehman was interviewed after the test match and they said they're very advanced in their selection process. So the announcement for the test squad to India is imminent. So with that in mind, I have come up with my squad and listeners, Joe and Paul have got their teams and we're going to sort of give you all our theories and crazy ideas of how we'd conquer the subcontinent. I'm going to start with mine and then you guys can argue with me and give me yours. So my thinking behind the team for India is that Australia needs three frontline quicks. I don't think you can have Hazelnut and Stark trying to carry the load for the fast bowlers throughout the whole series. I think it'll be too much and you need a third quick. So that's the first thing. You need three quicks and I think you need two spinners. And I've got a couple of ways of combining to get three quicks and two spinners into an 11. Okay, I'll give you in batting on it. Dave Warner to open the batting. His partner for this series, I've gone for Sean Marsh. A purely horses for courses strategy. I think Renshaw could go in the squad, but he shouldn't play. Just go for experience. I think what's got Australian cricket into trouble in the past is thinking that form in Australia counts for form in India. It doesn't, and we need to think differently. Marsh has experience in the subcontinent, and I can't believe I'm saying this. Sean Marsh to open the batting. What do you guys think of the openers?
I don't mind Sean Marsh being considered, and I find that hard to say as well because I've always not really rated him. But to be fair to him, he's got an average now of 40 in Test cricket, and he hasn't played Test cricket in India, but in Sri Lanka, he's got an average of 78. So I get you there. I would still go with Renshaw to open, given that he did score 180 on the SCG, a spinning wicket. I think he's a better batsman than Marsh, but I would certainly have Marsh in the squad. So kind of the inverse of what you're doing.
I retain Renshaw. I think, you know, it's a tough one. You've got the horses for courses philosophy, but then I also think you've got to take a career view of a guy like Renshaw. And, you know, you say he's got no experience in the subcontinent. Well, there's no better time to get that than the present. He's the form batsman. I think if you take if you rotate people in and out of a test side, I think you actually erode the character of the team. I think great teams are built on continuity. We saw that in our golden generation.
But I don't think so, because that golden generation, they won one series in India, 2004. So it's not like that golden team conquered the subcontinent. So I don't think so. And I think, you know, what if Matt Renshaw goes there, four tests, scores 50 runs, just has an absolute shocker. Then he comes back to the Ashes series and all of a sudden his spot's under fire and you've got him questioning his ability at test level.
So what are you going to do? You know,
say to him,
Are you going to shield him from any difficult series and only play him in series where he's going to plunder the
bowling? He's a 20-year-old player. He'll have plenty of time to get experience in India. He's probably never even been to India. So
I think your philosophy is right, Menas, in that you have to pick horses for courses in India, and form in Australia does not guarantee success. We've done it in the past. We've picked someone like Cowan for India, and it was kind of like he's not going to succeed over there. But I think on this case here...
No Cowan bashing.
On this case here, I think that Renshaw...
But more recently, Burns. I mean, as I said, he dominated here, went to Sri Lanka, looked at all sorts.
Agree, but I think that when faced with just the choice of who do I think is going to score more runs in India, Renshaw or Sean Marsh, I fall narrowly on the side of Renshaw, but I'd still have Marsh in the squad.
Well... Now, number three for Australia in India, I've elevated Smith from four to three. I think Smith, obviously, just a great player of spin bowling. We saw him come in at three in Sri Lanka and score 100. I just think that's the right spot for him on the subcontinent.
Don't dance around the issue of number three, Manners. You've dropped Usman Khawaja after we've just lauded him with his recent form. I just copy and paste my comments from Renshaw. I think, you know, I don't want to go back into history too far, but if you look at the side that was successful in 2004, there were players who had been there previously and, you know, got close but not succeeded. And it was that fire in their belly that ultimately got us that victory. So I think you've got to build a team over years. You can't just rotate people in and out based on kind of form. And
I'm replacing Khawaja with Steve Smith. So Steve Smith averages over 60 in Test cricket. So it's an upgrade. And Usman Khawaja in Sri Lanka looked awful.
Even in this he wasn't Robinson Crusoe.
Even at the SCG against Yasir Shah. Early on, he played some horrible slog, almost got out cheaply. I just don't think he's a good player of spin bowling, and I don't want to take the chance.
Okay, so what do you? So again, are you going to just pick Khawaja for home series over his career, or what's the plan? What, as a selector, what's your plan for Usman Khawaja?
He's number three in home series, all but subcontinental conditions.
No, I agree with Menas on that. If that's ultimately, I would still pick Khawaja because I think he's going to do okay over there. But Menas has taken the view that he's not, and I think if you do take that view, then I think logically that's what you have to have. You've got to have some lack of continuity and say, if someone's not going to succeed in the subcontinent but is going to succeed at home, that's fine. We've got to pick the players who are most likely to succeed. But having said all that, I still would pick Khawaja because I think that he has...
So Paul's agreed with me, but picked completely different players.
Yeah, Renshaw and Khawaja.
I've agreed with your philosophy, but disagreed with your analysis.
No, good. No, so thank you. I appreciate the support. Number four, coming in after Steve Smith, Peter Hanscom. Now, and this one is actually a little bit difficult for me because everyone says Peter Hanscom's a great player of spin, but he's never been tested over in the tough conditions he's going to face. But I think if we're going to give one young player a go, because Hans can play so deep in his crease, which is one of the methods to succeeding against spinners in the subcontinent, I think he's worth a shot. And he averages 100 in Test cricket.
Oh, I'd definitely pick him.
Yeah, I mean, his ability to play off the back foot will be a huge advantage under those conditions. But he also does like to stay leg side of the ball and play a lot through the offside, when we know that in Indian conditions, flicking through the leg side is the sort of method that the most successful Indian batsmen have employed. So, look, I think he gets a run in my side. I wouldn't want to drop
it. It is a risk, though, isn't it?
You can't. He's averaging. Well, he's just. He's averaging something. Above 50. And
four tests though. Pakistan were ordinary at the end. So I think. But I think it'll be interesting to see how he goes, because everybody's saying he's got this amazing method of playing spin. Well, now you got a chance to prove it against Jadeja and Ashwin. So we've all got Hanscom in. So this is the first unilateral selection.
I think we've all picked Warner as well, haven't we?
And Smith. But I mean,
and Smith,
of the ones that are a little bit controversial. So Hanscom's in there, number five. For Australia, in India, hold your breath, people. Listen to what I'm about to say. Glenn Maxwell at number five. My thinking behind this is twofold. He lives in India 2 months a year and has done for a few years, so he's intimately familiar with all the conditions that surround cricket there, and it won't be a foreign thing for him walking out to bat in the oppressive conditions we're going to find. Plus, he can play as the third spinner. I don't think he's good enough to be a second spinner, but I think he's good enough to be your third spinner, just to bowl, maybe 6-7 overs a day or something.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely pick Maxwell.
So you've said that your ultimate balance is three quicks, two spinners, but you've got a combination that gives you three quicks, three spinners as well?
No, I'm just making it clear that Maxwell's not the all-rounder, that the all-rounder's to come. So Maxwell's your third spinner.
So if he's the third spinner, a seamer misses out, right?
No, he's just a third spinner.
So you put six, you'll have six
and,
options.
Yeah, and you could Smith's your fourth spinner. Because I guarantee, whatever happens, the Indian batsmen are going to come at our spinners, and there's going to be times where you're just not going to be able to keep bowling them. So you bring Maxwell on for a few overs.
It's a good point, Smith being our fourth spinner. I think that we don't value our part-time spinners enough. And going to the conditions that could be spin-friendly, there are times when you want to just say, oh, well, it's just not working for the current spinners. Let's throw the ball to Maxwell, give him three or four overs. That hasn't worked. We'll throw the ball to Smith a couple of overs. I think that's an important little subplot.
It's a really good point. I think Steve Smith didn't bowl much this summer. Wouldn't it have been a great opportunity for him to kind of get a bit of rhythm with his own bowling, knowing that he's potentially going to have to do a bit more work in India? Menas, to your point about Maxwell, though, he's in my side but picked at number six. I think a spinning all-rounder is just the perfect combination for India because it just gives you so many options.
I think Menas is saying he's picking him as a batsman, and by the way, he might bowl a couple of overs. We're not banking on him to bowl anything, but he's a little bonus.
All right, now to number six in the order. I've got Peter Neville coming back in as the wicketkeeper and batting at six. I think he's the best gloveman in the country. He scored 60-not out against South Africa in Perth when others fell around him, so Wade has done nothing all summer except chunder next to the middle of the SCG, so on your bike, son. And then at number seven, I've gone for young Ashton Agar, and he plays as the second spinner. a lot of people will think that Agar's not ready for this challenge, but I think he is. He scored a lot of runs in Shield cricket over the last two summers. He scored, I think, 3 Shield hundreds over 2 years, which is as good as some of the batsmen we've been picking. Add to that, he took a 10-wicket haul at the SCG. Watching him bowl in the Big Bash, he's got much more maturity with the way he bowls. I think picking him as your second spinner and batting at 7 gives you a really good, long, deep batting order. What do you think of young Ashton Agar?
I'd have him in my squad and maybe not in my first 11, though.
This is your most controversial pick, and I can't see how he usurps Nathan Lyon to go from Lyon, who's been our number one spinner, suddenly drops down to our third spinner here. I don't see the justification for that, and I don't think Agar has got the results on the board to justify that either. Again, in my squad, I would have him as a similar option to Maxwell, you know, somebody who can bat, and I know he's the different weighting in that he's his primary skill is his spin bowling and his secondary skill is his batting, but again, I would have him in the squad for flexibility.
And then coming in after Agar, I've got Mitchell Stark, Jackson Bird and Josh Hazlewood as the three quicks in my attack. I think Bird's probably a difficult one because I'm not sure the conditions will suit, but then all the bowlers we have, like Pattinson and Cummins, that bowl quick and skiddy with reverse swing aren't fit. So I think you've just got to stick with a really good, solid unit that can bowl well as a group. And then my primary spinner for this tour is Stephen O'Keefe. So that's my attack. You've got O'Keefe and Agar and Maxwell as your three spinners, then Stark, Bird and Hazlewood. Lyon's my 12th man. My only other combination is you could sub in Mitchell Marsh as the third seamer for Ashton Agar and bring in Nathan Lyon for Jackson Bird. Do you like that combination better, Joe, where Mitch Marsh plays as the third bowler and you have O'Keefe and Lyon?
Yeah, that's one of my combinations as well, Menners. I do like that option. For me, Mitchell Marsh makes a lot more sense as an all-rounder than, say, Hilton Cartwright did, because Cartwright, we know, only bowled a couple of overs. So, again, this is...
Well, Mitchell Marsh is a genuine first-change bowler.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's proven that, and in those conditions.
Yeah, no, I actually think playing Mitchell Marsh at number 6 is a definite possibility in India.
And I guess one player that I really considered was James Faulkner with his ability to bowl those slow cutters, but just the way Virat Kohli and the rest of the Indian team hold him in utter disdain, I just don't think I'd make him suffer through that.
I don't like what Faulkner's doing with his current... He's doing a bit like what the quick bowler who bowls lots of slower balls.
Which one?
The OD, he was...
Clint Mackay?
Mackay, yeah. I think Faulkner is overdoing his slower balls a bit like Mackay was doing for a period and bowling so many of those over-the-wrist short balls. I think he's actually lost a little bit of his penetration.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the Indians just love savaging him.
I'd pick him.
You'd pick him. Yeah, I know you would. The rest of my squad then is Renshaw, Farwood Ahmed, James Pattinson, Adam Zampa, Holland, Khawaja and Mitch Marsh. So if they're not in the 11, so I'm taking 18. Now, guys, your turn. What are your big disagreements? Who are your big inclusions? Give it to me.
I agree with a lot of what you said, Menas. If I was picking my first 11, I would go with a lot of the same side that we had in the test match in Sydney. So Warner, Renshaw, Khawaja, Smith, the top four. I'd add in Maxwell into the side. I'd keep Hanscom in the side. And now, I don't want to go on and on about wicketkeeping, but I would say that whatever perceived differences there are in standard of Hanscom and Wade as a keeper, I think they're probably fairly similar. So I'd drop Wade and say I'd bring Faulkner into the side as my third bowler, my third seaming bowler. Man of the match in the World Cup final. He's got a very good first-class record with bowling. His batting can be explosive. And I think that his cutters and sometimes and his slower ball in Indian conditions could be quite effective. I'd have O'Keefe number 8, Stark at number 9, Hazlewood at number 10, and for my first 11, I'd be picking Farwood Ahmed and dropping Nathan Lyon. I think that Farwood Ahmed has bowled really well in the Big Bash. He's got a much better first-class record than Lyon. Lyon, in his overseas performances, he's averaged 140 with the ball in the UAE, 37 and 34 in India and Sri Lanka. Those figures aren't too bad, but in those series that he's played in India and Sri Lanka, other spinners from the opposition have done really, really well. I put Lyon at the same standard as someone like a Moeen Ali or a Gareth or a Batty who played for England in the recent series against India. They went okay. They didn't dominate. I don't think Lyon is going to dominate. I would have him in the squad, and I'd also, for the rest of the squad, I wouldn't mind taking 18 as well, Menes, if you're going to, and I'd include, so Lyon. I'd also bring Swepson over there. Swepson, Agar, Wade, Zampa, Sean Marsh, Bailey, and Jackson Bird in the rest of my squad.
Bailey, I like Bailey. Love that one. Afawen Ahmed making 11 is a really big call. I like the inventiveness because if you watch the way he bowls, it would suit those conditions. He bowls a bit like Anil Kumble, a bit quicker, a bit flatter. We know how many wickets he took. He's certainly in my squad. And as to your point about numbers, Cricket Australia have got loads of dosh. Just take 18 or 20 players over because even if they don't play, they're going to get invaluable experience moving forward.
Absolutely, and it cost us so much in Sri Lanka, as you made the point before, Menes, where we had to fly...
John Holland was flown over.
Flown in from... I mean, how could he possibly be expected to succeed when he's been flown in at the last minute? Cricket Australia does have loads of dosh. And when you're over there, you know, when they go to Dubai and practice and practice and practice... Maybe none of them will be able to pick Schwepson, and he'll absolutely decimate them in the training. This is an asset for us to have over here. Let's err on the side of having more rather than few.
And Joe, give us your main squad.
My side
action
is Renshaw, Warner, Khawaja, Smith, Hanscom, Maxwell, Neville, Stark, Hazelwood, Lyon, and Bird. My variation on that.
So who are your two spinners?
Maxwell and Lyon.
Well, I think that's. What are you thinking? I mean. Maxwell's not a frontline spinner. Neither is Nathan Lyon.
Man, is you're just being controversial.
No, but seriously, do you think that's enough, though? Maxwell.
So you're not picking O'Keefe in the 11?
I've got my variation is Mitchell Marsh instead of Maxwell, and O'Keefe comes in for Bird. That's my variation on the...
I think we're going to get spanked if we take Joe's team. I hope the selectors aren't listening to you.
The Farwood Ahmed's an interesting one because he's not getting picked for Victoria at the moment. We know that.
But did Victoria play on the subcontinent?
But just hear me out, Menes. One of the best
not my
readers
best quality
of spinning talent in the country, Kerry O'Keefe, I think has advocated for Farwood Ahmed to be picked. So I think he would be an interesting selection. I think having a leg spinner in India would be a huge advantage. And it's funny, we've got so many of these young leg spinners coming through, like Zampa and Cameron
Swepson.
Boyce and Swepson. Imagine Swepson took a Schweppes classic catch.
I don't think Swepson should go.
Anyway, back to the substance of the matter. Others who I would have in the squad, Sean Marsh, Ashton Agar, and I would take Farwood Ahmed, obviously O'Keefe as well. So, you know, my side, I think, you know, has continuity in mind as well as some added flexibility with Maxwell.
One other player that we probably should add to the squad. I think he's retired though, but if we brought Brett Jeeves along, that could keep Wolf honest.
No, he just comes like that mascot.
One thing on O'Keefe, I think he's the key to the series for Australia. I think that in the past we've been saying we've failed in the subcontinent because our batsmen haven't handled spin. That's true, but I think our biggest failure is our bowlers haven't had enough of a spinning weapon to do the damage to the other sides that they've done to us. And I think O'Keefe has the numbers to do that. He's got a first-class average of 23.7 with the ball. That's an amazingly good average. You look at someone like Jadeja, who on the surface bowls a little bit like O'Keefe, both left-arm orthodox. Jadeja's record outside of India is deplorable. So if you draw a line through that and say, well, O'Keefe, in Australian conditions, has been able to average that. When he goes to the subcontinent, maybe, just maybe, he can be our secret. And that's what I'm hoping for.
I think that's right. In the analysis of the England series, I think what Jadeja does is bowl very accurately. He doesn't turn the ball a lot, which is similar to
He uses the natural variation.
The natural variation in the pitch, which is what somebody like O'Keefe will do.
Well, listeners, that was our three squads and teams for the Indian tour. We couldn't agree on a squad, so that means there's a lot of debate and food for thought. It'll be interesting to see what if the selectors take on board what we've said. I'm sure they're listening, so G'day, boys. Just he's out. That's our best go at it. Good luck. Listeners, thanks so much for downloading the show again. As you may have noticed, that they're being released a little bit spasmodically or sporadically at the moment because of trying to fit in with test summers and all that. And remember, don't forget about the Big Smash Cricket podcast, which is Paul and I's podcast, all about the BBL and WBBL. This week, we're releasing a show with an in-depth interview with the chief of the BBL, Anthony Everard. So get on board. Joe, thanks for coming along.
Pleasure, manners. Good fun.
Paul, thanks for coming along.
Thanks, guys.
And thanks for downloading the show. We'll be back next week.
What a marvellous stroke. He's played no better shot than that in the whole of the series.